You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 28th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, independent freelance journalist Alexander Zaychek, author of Owning the Sun, People's History of Monopoly Medicine from Aspirin to COVID-19 Vaccines. Also on the program today, Biden publicly calls for Putin's ouster in a quiet part loud fail. Meanwhile, Russian military assault resets to a focus on the East, perhaps as a precursor to a Putin exit strategy. Speaking of which, Zelensky says Ukraine ready to discuss neutrality. Biden calls for a minimum tax on 100 millionaires. People with $100 million or more. Bernie and other Democratic senators, meanwhile, push for a windfall tax for oil and gas producers. And speaking of oil and gas producers, new report on Manchin's coal interests, mixed with his government positions, show how he became very, very rich. Judiciary Committee begins to move KBJ's nomination to the floor. Republicans will slow walk it. Probably won't make it there for at least a week. Joe Biden's job approval falls to its lowest level. Toilet time. Losing his base.
Toilet time.
It's like in the toilet.
My God.
Ginny Thomas May here from January 6th committee. And convicted Republican Congressman Fortenberry, resigns. Second booster coming for 50 and up. That's right. Uncle Sammy's getting one. And for the first time in the 50-year history of observing, an East Antarctica ice shelf completely collapses. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is Monday, start of a new week. Here, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. Are you still riding the high from the live show? We're all that everyone else here is just, it's crazy.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's a little embarrassing because if you didn't buy the live ticket, you may not have seen that Sam made a bad joke and I got up and smacked him across the face.
And then, of course, in the transitive property that exists, it basically gave license
for Will Smith.
For Will Smith, among other people. Yeah. I mean, he just was the first one apparently to have seen the show. And
it's a new trend.
Yep.
Yeah. So if you see people smacking comedians, it's not the Will Smith. It's the Emma Vigeland.
Former comedians.
Right.
But if you're going to smack a former comedian over a joke, you're certainly going to smack an active comedian.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big fears that is out there. We'll talk about the Will Smith thing.
I mean, come on. If you guys are defending the Will Smith smack at Chris Rock, like, yeah.
I am?
If anybody in the audience is, like, let's examine your relationship with toxic masculinity. Let's be real.
Yeah, but we will talk about it. I mean, frankly, I got to be honest. I almost like tweeted out last night, like I felt guilty not having a take on this. And so because I don't care.
Yeah, there's certain things that happen and I get mainly my main response is to be annoyed that it's going to take up showtime.
I have to say,
oh,
honestly,
come on, it's going
to
be fun.
No,
it's going to be fun.
I will say this. I don't even care about the, I really don't, the Will. But I'm more interested in the takes.
Oh, yeah.
About the Will Smith thing and the Chris Rock thing. And the other thing is, I am quite sure that I know the person who wrote the joke.
Mm. He should have done a Scientology joke. That would have been a bit better. That's the best way to hit Will Smith as the weirdo that he is.
In its complete speculation on my part, I would never say the guy's name. We were friends a long time ago. I didn't invite him to my wedding and, you know, things went south.
Oh.
But, little did he know. I mean, it wasn't the marriage was not going to hold anyway. So, but I'm quite with my limited knowledge. This is not firsthand knowledge, but with my knowledge of these events in general, I am quite sure this joke was written moments before. It was said, you know, it was, they look who's out in the audience and then some guy writes the joke, but, somebody who's going back references that are 30 years old. So that's why I have a pretty good notion. Like sometimes a joke has a fingerprint on it. Let me put it that way. And I recognize the fingerprint. All right. But we'll talk about that in the fun half. We'll also talk more about the absolute disaster that took place in the live show. The live show was great. It was so great seeing folks come out. Our audience is just fantastic. Everybody who came on to the show was great. Usually you contemplate a live show and you're like, okay, this may not work, or you know, there'll be like 5 or 10 minutes where people are like and we did. I think the show ended up being like 2 hours and 20 minutes long. We got in a little bit of trouble because we weren't supposed to go that long. And so, you know,
I felt my drinking buzz throughout the evening was like very manageable. Matt might say differently, but
I have some very bad news for you.
Yeah.
It was not the evening. It was a 2 p.m.
Oh,
show.
Right. Yeah. I mean, throughout the day.
Yeah.
The day.
Yeah.
So maybe not drinking, so much.
The day drinking you did was very, very under control.
Yeah, I'm kind of proud about that. Yeah. Yes,
that's great.
Shout out to Train Boy for the Mahoo, a 4-pack.
We'll talk more about it, but it was great. I want to thank everybody who came, who streamed it, and certainly all the guests. I couldn't have been happier. And it, you know, after having not done a live show in 3 years. It was really great. And I cannot wait to wait another 3 years, to do another. No, we actually have, you can come and see Boston, the original Big Lie show. And that is, May 15th at, 2 p.m. at the Wilbur Theater. There's still some tickets left, but I'm getting the sense we're going to sell out. Let me just say this. We have a special guest coming. When you get there and find out who the special guest is, which you will not find out until that person enters the stage, you're going to be super psyched. That's all I can say. I mean, you're going to love seeing us too, but yeah, you're going to be super psyched about it.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Yes, and thanks to everybody for coming out and all the kind words after the show. If you're watching today, it was really, really appreciated for sure.
Joe Biden on Saturday, delivering a speech in Warsaw, Poland. A couple of things you should be aware of that I suspect. Some of this stuff was walked back by the White House. Also, keep in mind that the American public and a majority of Republicans and independents, not necessarily Democrats, but the numbers are high for the Democrats too, feel that Joe Biden has not been strong enough in his response to Russia. And so I'm not convinced. Sometimes there are times where you say something publicly You walk it back so that there's two different messages that are out there.
Yeah.
Joe's too aggressive is one of them.
That's never going to be the message. No. I mean, the point, every time there's a Democrat responding to some sort of foreign policy thing, it's always they're too weak.
Yes.
I mean, so I find this to be a fool's errand and also what he says here to be dangerous.
Absolutely. Here's Joe Biden in Warsaw.
They stood for solidarity here in Poland. And together, it was an unmistakable, undeniable force of the people that the Soviet Union could not withstand. And we're seeing it once again today with the brave Ukrainian people showing that their power of many is greater than the will of any one dictator. So in this hour, let the words of Pope John Paul burn as brightly today. Never, ever give up hope. Never doubt. Never tire. Never become discouraged. Be not afraid. A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never erase a people's love for liberty. Brutality will never grind down their will to be free. Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. For free people refuse to live in a world of hopelessness and darkness. We will have a different future, a brighter future, rooted in democracy and principle, hope and light, of decency and dignity, of freedom and possibilities. For God's sake, this man cannot remain in power. God bless you all. And may God defend our freedom.
Yeah, that's not a good thing to say when you're supposed to be brokering negotiations for peace in order to save Ukrainian lives. And just lives in general.
Honestly. Here is the question. I mean, there's multiple questions. Without a doubt, this is a bad idea to say this, as far as I'm concerned, too. I mean, because, it gives Putin a new pivot point as to, you know, like, it gives Putin... If the Biden administration, NATO, whomever, the West, genuinely wants Putin out, that does not help their case. I mean, that does not, like,
no.
Because you do not want Putin to have any type of rallying around him by his domestic critics. And his argument, of course, is like, this is all made up by the West. This is the West encroachment, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't want Biden to give him the proof of that.
And it's one thing for Lindsey Graham to say it. It's another thing for Biden to say it.
Exactly.
Which is why, I mean, the White House is saying, oh, this was off the cuff. I have no idea if that's true or not. Either way, it was stupid as hell.
Well, that's the thing, is that it's quite possible. Let's put it this way. It's quite possible that Biden was just like, you know, like freelancing, for God's sakes, we got to get this guy, you know, out of the country. You know, like
that tracks with him.
Get him, you know, yeah, that tracks. It doesn't. It's hard. But it's also quite possible that, you know, he knows, like, his polling is down. People want him to be more aggressive with Russia, and that, like, oh, this is my sentiment, but I didn't mean to say it. Who knows?
But that's
it's
the limits of those kinds of things, right? One, see how easily he's able to just slip into, you know, I'm going to promote regime change easily, right? Like that's just the way that our government perceives these things. But two, that's the limits of looking of popularism or looking at polling for these kinds of things. Because no, I've liked the way that he's approached diplomacy. And it seems like they're trying to broker diplomacy behind the scenes thus far. But doing that to appease some imagined constituency, I think, domestically, it's dangerous.
Very dangerous. Very dangerous. We'll talk more about that as the show progresses.
Sam, your camera just went out.
That is weird. I will be back. What the... Hold on.
It just seemed like it restarted.
That is weird.
Maybe we should just take a quick break.
Let me refresh ping for 1 second. Hold on.
I just got a thing that said that my resolution was changed.
Hmm.
Hold on, let me reload and get back in here.
Oh, hello, Bradley and Matt. Hey, say hello. That you're zooming in on their camera right now. You gotta.
Well, I'm doing mine, so.
Oh. It's working on yours?
Yeah. Let's see. There we go. I am back, ladies and gentlemen. Just in time to deliver to you a word from our sponsors today. We have three of them. One is...
Oh, there he is!
Scared the hell out of me. That was so loud. Did you see me jump? Did I jump?
Yeah, you jumped.
I was like, oh my God, what the... He's coming! Oh shit, it's me!
That's our special guest on the show.
In a moment, we'll get to Alexander Zajcek, who's written a book, Owning the Sun, People's History of Monopoly Medicine from Aspirin to COVID-19 Vaccines. I interviewed him, I think, for the second Peacock show, specifically about Gates or Moderna. I cannot remember which one it was, but we'll talk to him about it because we have no way of searching.
Was that New Republic piece?
Yes.
Yes, I remember you did do that interview. That was a great piece.
Anyway. Yes. But meanwhile, very important. These days, stay hydrated. Well, it's always important to stay hydrated. Baseball season has started, at least for me and my son, coaching once again. And we go out, we go to the park. Can I get one of those, Gatorade type of drinks? He says, as we go by the thing. And I'm like, no, there's garbage in that. But you can have some of the... hydration drink or sports drink, whatever I called it to him, that I have in our bag, which of course is Liquid IV. Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. Its multiplier in 16 ounces of water hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Comes in great flavors, watermelon, lemon lime, strawberry, pina colada, and more. And Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients. It's non-GMO, free from gluten, dairy, and soy, as opposed to those garbage ones that they sell in the park. Well, they sell them everywhere.
Yeah.
Science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. Because certain minerals, I don't know the specifics, but I do know certain minerals provide better transport of other minerals and vitamins into your body. And Liquid IV is on a mission to change the world. The company has donated over 20 million servings globally. So check it out. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco. You can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com. Use the promo code MAJORITYREP at checkout. I got my tangerine right here with me. It's 25% off anything you order when you use promo code MAJORITYREP at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today, liquidiv.com, promo code MAJORITYREP. Check it out, folks. Also, the jobless claims, I believe, were at their lowest levels since 1969 this past week, or maybe it was last week. And right now, there's all sorts of reports that you're seeing at least some or maybe even majority of employers are trying to enhance the employee experience and make that a top priority in 2022. I was actually talking to a buddy of mine who he was saying he's going back into the company. He said, it's really crazy because we lose a lot of people after the first like 6-8 months. And he's talking about stuff like onboarding and this and that.
Yeah.
He's like, and they don't really, it ends up being a problem for us. We can't, it's hard to get employees that fit properly and keep them happy at their place. And I didn't say you should try ZipRecruiter because it's not the type of conversation we were having, but ZipRecruiter is what did it for us here at the Majority Report. ZipRecruiter's matching technology helps you find the right people for your roles fast. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/majority. The best time to look for new employees when you don't need one, folks. Because you don't want to, you know, get that 2 weeks notice and then be like, what am I going to do? ZipRecruiter uses its powerful technology to find and match the right candidates up with your job. Then it proactively presents these candidates to you. Super easy to review the recommended candidates, invite the top choices to apply for your job. That, of course, encourages them to apply faster. They see that you want them. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. That's what happened when we used ZipRecruiter. Well, I got a bunch of actually really quality people in the first day, but it reached out, found Brendan, brought him into our system. I was able to organize the whole thing because their UI is fantastic. That means user interface.
Yeah.
Thanks. And I did not coin that phrase. And ZipRecruiter was great. And then we got Bradley through Brendan. So ZipRecruiter continues to pay dividends. You can find the right employees for your workplace with ZipRecruiter. Try it for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MAJORITY majority. ZipRecruiter, it is the smartest way to hire. And lastly, you got a small business. A lot of people doing more like, you know, sort of side hustles, whatever it is. You're Matthew Film Guy. You're auctioning off all sorts of things. You got to ship them out. But don't forget, time is money. You don't want to waste either. By leaving your office or going to waiting in the line, maybe at the post office or whatever it is. Well, stamps.com lets you print official postage right from your computer, and it saves you money in the process in 2 different ways. One, you're not spending time that is not productive, and so you get more leisure time. Sometimes, you know, time can be money. And also, like literally, there's huge discounts. For more than 20 years, Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses. And with Stamps.com, you get discounts you can't find anywhere else, like up to 40% off U.S. Postal Service rates and 76% off of UPS. Doesn't matter whether you're in office sending invoices, whether you've got like, I don't know, an Etsy shop or a Depop shop, as it were, full-blown warehouse shipping out orders, Stamps.com will make your life easier. Get access to all the post office and UPS shipping services you need right from your computer. You just need a computer and a standard printer. Nothing else. Super easy to get this going. Mile and I are starting to look at it for her Depop business.
Oh, nice.
Because I'm taking the hit.
I know. I've heard she's taking advantage of you.
Totally.
But in an entrepreneurial way.
Yes. She's both being an entrepreneur and an entrepreneur when it comes to taking advantage of me. But if I can knock down her shipping rates, that comes back and helps me. Stamps.com is also the way back in the day when I was sending out DVDs. Meanwhile, stop overpaying for shipping with Stamps.com. Sign up promo code Majority Report for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the page. Enter code Majority Report. All of these links will be in our YouTube and podcast descriptions. And as always, if you want the free show, free of commercials, become a member. Join the MajorityReport.com. Okay, quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Alexander Zajcik.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the on the phone, on the Zoom, whatever. It's not the Zoom.
On the line.
On the line. We have freelance journalist Alex Zajcek, author of Owning the Sun, A People's History of Monopoly Medicine from Aspirin to COVID-19 Vaccines. Alexander, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate you having you here. I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's start at the real beginning. I mean, like this dynamic of patents and of particularly in the context of medicine. But let's talk about where this. We have patents called for in the Constitution of the United States, obviously. But let's talk about the sort of, prior to that, where we start to first see this type of like notion of intellectual property, I guess, loosely said. And then we can move into patents as why we have them in this country.
The interesting thing about patents is they sort of begin life as a negative, not as a positive. Because in Elizabethan England, there was a general ban on monopoly that was a way to constrain crown power. And the patent system was a carve out within that general ban on monopolies. Inventors' rights were the exception to this general ban, and they were made an exception on the belief that they would spur economic growth by attracting foreign inventors to England, that they would spur the creativity and imagination of the English people and lead to new inventions, new trades, new techniques. But they were always controversial, this exception of inventors' rights. And there were those, including many of the people that we associate with the rise of free market capitalism, John Locke, Adam Smith, who were very skeptical that this exception was justified. And they believed that, in fact, it would constrain knowledge, the free flow of knowledge, and would inhibit the growth of new industries by incentivizing the blocking of information flow. And that is basically where we get inventors' rights, was this very controversial carve out to a general ban on monopoly, which was a way to put a limit on royal power, which was very corruptly handing out monopolies on all sorts of trades, including in the colonies, which inherited this exception from the British.
Do we have any, I don't even know how you would begin this, but has there ever been an attempt in terms of like on a data basis to assess this? Like, I mean, I look at like the developments when we have like more open technology, right? Like when we have the internet gives us a good example of like sort of software that is open software. And we see people, build things for it and build off it and whatnot. But do we have any like sense of that sort of fundamental sort of belief that providing a patent of any length of time necessarily spurs invention, broadly amongst a society?
There are studies of different industries and sectors, and it's still a heated debate. That's an important point, that this is not a settled matter where there's some sort of proof along the lines of physics that this is a functioning innovation spur. Absolutely not. And there is considerable evidence that the opposite is true, beginning with the entire history of scientific advance before we had patent systems, where somehow innovation happened without the dangling fruit of becoming a billionaire during a pandemic. So there's that, but there's also just recent history where you can see blocks and walls put up around very important fields of research that inhibited, slowed down, and weakened lines of inquiry. I mean, just think about the two mRNA vaccines. What if there had been an intellectual property pool that had forced Moderna and Pfizer and their government patrons to put their research into a common a common area that everyone could examine. Maybe we wouldn't have had two mRNA vaccines that required these incredibly low temperatures to transport in store. We might have been able to have advances there. So yes, it's a valid question, and one that is very much a subject of debate still.
And I would also guess that, I mean, outside of the innovation in and of itself, there's also a gatekeeping quality to it as well, right? In terms of how one can develop connections to secure patents, the money that's involved. Can you talk a little bit about how that keeps some people out of the process?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly political institution, the patent system. By definition, it is the government intervening in the economy to protect rights of what is now mostly corporations. It used to be, you know, sole inventors, these backwoods kind of the myth of the backwoods lone genius, which has not been true for a long time. So now it's basically the government intervening to protect the rights of large corporations, which is extremely political. And grotesquely so, because those corporations have now gamed the patent system to the point where the government is no longer even really the one calling the shots, but the industries, especially in pharmaceuticals, are obliterating the constitutional mandate of the patent system and the rules that had been applied to it for a long time. Now you've got these monopolies that go on for 50 years. They're basically de facto endless monopolies when they were supposed to end after a certain number of years.
I want to get back to that obliteration in a moment, but also, you know, while we're still on sort of like the, broadly speaking, the general topic of assessing the value of patents to society at large. There's also a tremendous amount of things that have been developed. I know this from having talked to some medical VCs, essentially. There's also a tremendous amount of things that have been developed, particularly in the context of medicine, that would be incredibly helpful to people, but the whatever company could not find a way to necessarily make it profitable. So they sit on these patents as a way of making sure that nobody else finds a way to make it profitable. And we have all sorts of things that could be very helpful to the American public or to the world, frankly, that are just shelved because someone hasn't figured out how to make it profitable and they're sitting on it. You know, almost like in the same way that, like, you know, Hollywood will buy up a film script and just make sure that nobody else, produces it, because the worst thing in the world for you is like, I bought this script and now Disney's turning it into a multi-million dollar hit. It makes me look like I don't know what I'm doing. But even in that business, there's a turnaround time at least, but So do we have any data on that? Because this is the part that we can't see, right? We don't know. There's nobody out there to aggregate all the things that we don't have because they're behind this sort of curtain.
Yeah, this gets at another betrayal, the original betrayal of the constitutional mandate for the patent system in the first place, which was to spur, and I'm quoting Article 1, Section 8, progress in science and the useful arts. The idea that a patent could be purchased like any property right or protected like any other piece of property for the purpose of obstruction and to protect market share and block the development of that idea or knowledge, to block progress in science and the useful arts, is directly counter to the language in the Constitution. And it unfortunately has been happening since the rise of the corporate research lab in the Gilded Age. That's really when we started to see this behavior. And the courts stamped their approval on it. They basically rejected the constitutional language and said, no, it's just a piece of property like anything else. And there are some very famous instances of the government intervening to wrest those patents out of the hands of defensive corporations, using them defensively in the public interest. And one of the most famous examples of that is in 1954, the Eisenhower administration took a crowbar to the Bell Labs patent vault and basically disseminated all of the technologies that resulted in what we now call Silicon Valley. Transistors, early solid state transistors, lasers, all that early technology in the 50s was diffused as called for in the Constitution, not because the patent system was functioning, but because it had become this sclerotic corporate defensive fortress tool, and the government had to step in and smash it. And there are other instances of that. It should happen a lot more often, but yeah, it's a problem, and it's been one for a long time.
What I mean, just go back into when that became, you know, when that that decision to allow patents, which were sort of like a unique intervention by the government, to become almost, you know, banally other types of property, right? Like, when did that first develop? And then we'll jump up to, you know, the late 70s, early 80s, when this thing sort of like gets really sort of hypercharged, I guess.
You start to see the seeds of that legal revolution in the Jacksonian years. He thought that he was democratizing the patent system by turning the patent into just a piece of physical property that could be done with whatever you wanted if you were the owner. And it started to really gain steam and undermine the constitutional basis of the patent system in the 1880s, 1890s, with the rise of these huge corporate research labs. Westinghouse, Alexander Graham Bell is probably the best known of them, in which they, you know, embraced this old idea of the Franklinian genius. But in fact, their corporate practice with regard to patents was undermining the soil that gives rise to the lone individual genius, because they can't research anything because these patent thickets are amassed by these corporate research labs and these corporations. So they were in fact choking off the possibility of future Franklins, while embracing this idea that had become completely anachronistic. And in the New Deal, that's when you have the government finally say, wait a second, this is a folklore that you guys are talking about. The patent system does not in any way resemble this myth from the early 19th century. It has in fact been degraded and corrupted, and the government has to step in and intervene, or else this is just going to get worse and worse, which is in fact what's happened.
Okay. So, first off, we should say that there's never been a piece of technology or an invention in medicine or any bit of progress in any form whatsoever in the, I don't know, invention world, as it were, that has not been based upon work that has been done prior, right? Like, I mean, this should go without saying, but there's nobody who started from baseline zero and just created something new. It all is based upon work that has existed before. So when you start to throttle the availability of that work in narrow areas or broad areas, you're inhibiting these things. So what was there anything material that happened during the New Deal era to change the patent system? Or was there just a sort of renewed vigor of antitrust that sort of like after the fact implicated the patent system?
No, the New Dealers, beginning of the so-called late New Deal of 1936, were extremely conscious of the corruption of the patent system in this country. And they made it a focus of their studies and their work. In the Department of Justice became extremely involved in patent enforcement, and they raised the bar for corporations to claim monopolies on invention. And part of the reason they did that was exactly what you just said. It was sort of an epistemological insight of the late New Dealers that knowledge does not spring from a single individual mind in any instance. It is a cumulative trans-historical process. And the idea of trying to put a stake in any one invention doesn't really make sense. And this goes all the way back to the ancients, which is why there was so much resistance to the concept of inventors' rights for so long. Knowledge was understood to be the shared charge of all humanity and all of the people that contribute to that constantly growing store of knowledge. And then you had a sort of Christianization of this idea, where trying to claim knowledge became a sin of sinemy, as a trafficking in spiritual things of spiritual value, because they were gifts from God and everybody had them and everybody contributed to them. And the Enlightenment sort of re-secularized this idea. And it's a very deep tradition because it's such a basic, obvious insight into how things happen. And they don't just spring from the floorboards of a company's in-house inventors. They are carried over from the centuries. Isaac Newton famously said, if I see farther, it's because I stand on the shoulders of giants. This is not a new idea, but it's one that unfortunately has been forgotten. And any sort of patent reforms of the sorts that are needed will begin with this insight, as the New Dealers started with this cornerstone.
Did they provide any structural reform to the system that had lasting implications, or was basically it just became a sort of like a culture within the Department of Justice and antitrust that once we get up into this sort of Borkian era of antitrust, that culture essentially of enforcement goes away? And so was there any structural reforms that were done at that time?
What they did was they maintained an extremely high public interest standard for corporations to claim monopolies on research and invention. And that high standard was measured against the very recent experience of these corporations allying with Nazi industry in basically cartel arrangements based on patents. So it wasn't just an economic issue in the US, it was also a national security issue. And the New Dealers were extremely serious about honoring the constitutional charge to diffuse knowledge through the patent system rather than allow it to be used as a block and as a way to maximize market share, not just in the US, but globally with official enemies.
Okay, so the next big sort of change in that regime, although I guess it gets a little bit diluted as we get further away from the New Deal, happens in during the Borkian, I guess, Reagan era, right? Will you walk us through, I guess, both Stevenson Widler or Bayh Dole. These are the ones in the Senate, ones in the House, the measures that are taken to sort of like, I don't know how you would characterize it, but to sort of, I don't know, create a even more sort of exploitive patent regime. And also, which I did not know, the creation of basically the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which I had no idea emanated out of this. Will you talk about those changes?
Sure. So World War II was when federal research really came into its own. Federal scientific research was a trickle compared to what we saw during World War II with everything from the Manhattan Project to the Industrial Penicillin Project. And it was understood during the war that that research commitment was going to carry over into peacetime. The days of minimal federal funding of science were over. And then the question emerged, who is going to have access to the fruits of all this research? And the history of the United States up until that time had been mixed. There was a dangerous precedent in World War I where the corporations walked away with all the patents and then ended up becoming large corporations allied with the Nazis for the next World War. And the New Dealers were determined to avoid that happening again. And they wanted to institute a policy, a default government patent policy, where research that was funded by the U.S. Treasury would retain into the hands of the government and the people. It would be under public control. Now, the contractors who were working with the government in this federal research establishment that was clearly coming into view wanted to have control. So basically, between 1945 and Bayh Dole and then Stevenson Widler, which you mentioned, you have a tug of war between this New Deal vision of publicly funded science under public control and industry as a default matter, taking control of patents resulting from government research. And that was 25 years of extremely hard fought, 10-yard fight, political warfare. One big event in there was John F. Kennedy, intervening with regard to medical science and saying, no, corporations must meet an extremely high public interest standard to be granted a monopoly on that research, especially medicine. And it was very hard for them to meet that standard. Because in most cases, how can you argue against diffusion? Why wouldn't you want more companies able to research this stuff? Why wouldn't you want more companies able to produce it to lower prices and create a competitive market? There's really no good reason in the vast majority of cases to prefer private monopoly over public control, which results in open access to this knowledge. And that was overturned in Bayh-Dole. So basically between Kennedy and Reagan, you have this tussle. And then once it flipped, once that switch flipped during Reagan, and then it accelerated under Clinton, which, you know, was, we all know what that administration was. Even now, it's still moving, if only by inertia, very much in industry's favor. And there may be some conversation within the current administration about how to stop that, but it's not clear that they'll get anything done.
Talk about the development of the Court of Appeals. I mean, I was just like, this is, I've talked about that court. This is where much of what the administrative state, the federal government does, you know, gets hashed out, as it were. And it really is, I mean, sadly, you know, that process is pretty problematic in many respects, because this is where, like, you know, this is the existence of that court sort of increases, I guess, the likelihood in certain situations that, like, industry lawyers come in and they chop apart, Dodd-Frank, let's say, and SEC regulations and FDA and EPA. But it was it the patent that was the big impetus behind this?
Yes, along with flipping the New Deal Kennedy policy in favor of default government ownership. Pharmaceutical and chemical industry was extremely focused on taking away the power of liberal federal court judges to hear infringement cases and to determine where that public interest standard was with regard to patent monopolies, especially when it came to medical science. And they finally got it under Reagan. And what did Reagan do? He replaced those often liberal-leaning judges with industry patent lawyers and lawyers.
Just to be clear, they were afraid of it showing up in, let's say, the second district.
Exactly. Court of Appeals, especially the second district,
which is like the New York region, essentially. And so this is court packing, right? Like, this is, it's just by another name.
It's like court inventing and then court packing. It's even
right,
worse.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I don't like the results that are coming out of the courts that exist. So I'm going to create a new court. And then, of course, I'm going to put my people in there, and it's going to create a new culture that comes out of that court. I mean, for a long time, you will see, like, the fifth district, I think, Court of Appeals is circuit court of appeals is like Texas in that area. And it's much more conservative. So these courts create their own sort of like culture that is reflective a little bit of their region, or is, I guess, reflective of their region. And in this instance, we've had that that dynamic in this circuit court of appeals. It gets worse when you have majority Republicans than Democrats, but still this underlying sort of like problem with antitrust and whatnot is highly present there. And I had no idea that that court, the impetus was there, was to protect.
It's a federal court. They're all appointed, and it has effectively flipped the ratio of monopolies being knocked down. It used to be 20% survived appeal, and now it's something like 80 or even more. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's very high.
Has it gotten better than it was at that time, that court?
It's still doing what it was meant to do, effectively.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
the industry's in no hurry to get rid of it.
All right. So let's move into sort of what we're seeing more more specifically, you know, with COVID. I mean, you and I have talked about this in the context of Bill Gates. We've talked about it in the context of Moderna, but that was on the other Peacock show. So I'm not afraid to go back over some of this, because the role of Gates in this, because that to me seems like, but for Bill Gates, the pressure would have been far greater on Moderna and Pfizer,
you know, both directly and I think just sort of like in terms of what the perspective is on all this. Will you talk about, you know, Gates's role in this and, you know, his fealty to monopolies over these things has sort of trumped making sure that we don't have a problem with COVID or attempt a really legitimate attempt to get everyone vaccinated?
Yeah, well, you were right when you said that it would have been a lot harder for these companies to make the case that they should retain complete control of IP during a pandemic, because they're not very adept at making moral arguments that don't really exist. And we saw this during the HIV/AIDS crisis when they eventually had to climb down from their lawsuit against Nelson Mandela. And what do you know? This is right around the time Bill Gates pops up on the public health scene as he's being sued for antitrust on two continents. And he has this enormously expensive reputation laundering operation kick in. And when he lands on the global public health debate, he lands on the side of the companies who were being excoriated around the world for suing the Mandela trying to produce or import generic antiretrovirals. Since that time, in the intervening 20 years, he has built up this very well-known philanthropic organization focused on global public health issues. And whatever absolute good some of those programs have accomplished, they play a very important function in a larger debate around the system that creates these enormous inequities in the first place. And he has shown zero interest in questioning the assumptions underlying this system, including during the pandemic, crucially during the pandemic, when there was a discussion taking place about making vaccines a global public good, of suspending rules as usual, business as usual, when governments were using this language and there was a medicines access movement pushing hard to create space for alternatives, who shows up again? Bill Gates, the good guy, with a solution that he claims can solve this problem. And he says, look, we don't have to suspend business as usual. We can have equity. We can solve all these problems. Suddenly, you have medicine access groups on one side, the industry on the other, and then a triangulation taking place. And the more you look at Bill Gates's role in his groups, the harder it becomes to avoid the conclusion that he's essentially running an extremely effective interference operation for the pharmaceutical industry, because these conversations take on a very different dynamic when he's in the picture.
But that's how he became a very wealthy man, is by propping up intellectual property rights, and both in his, you know, the computer field, and now he's taken that to the global stage in terms of global health. Like, that is what is so fascinating to me. And there are some cracks in his public persona as this big philanthropist. But can you talk a bit more about how he specifically has, like, laundered his role in keeping drugs away from people and protecting intellectual property and making it seem like he's actually some sort of benevolent billionaire who's providing those drugs for the rest of the world?
Yeah, I mean, you're right that it's who he is in a very fundamental way. But the weird thing about Gates is it goes back even before he made his money, when he was just a geeky teenager, sort of getting his toes in the early Silicon Valley scene. He was writing these screeds against the open source ethos of the early Silicon Valley, which was partly a result of that Bell Labs antitrust suit that we talked about earlier, because the Silicon Valley understood that that's kind of where they come from. And also there's the psychedelic influence, who knows, but Gates was like this lone figure early on arguing very loudly and obnoxiously for knowledge monopolies, even as a teenager. It's kind of bizarre. So yes, this is who he is. And in the context of the two great pandemics of the last quarter century, he has come down with all of his resources and influence to try to keep the global IP regime, as enshrined in the World Trade Organization's TRIPS regime, very much firmly on its rails. And he has devoted all of his influence in the media, his financial influence, his influence in international institutions, including the World Health Organization, to make sure that argument does not proceed and that IP is enshrined under all circumstances, including global public health crises.
Has the failure to get the world vaccinated and the failure of was it COVAX, right, is the thing that came out of the UN?
Yeah.
Has that failure been sort of like digested and people have reacted to it? Or is it just sort of like it feels like it's just sort of like filtered into the ether and nobody's really talking about it? Because he had specific sort of like proclamations as to how this was going to go, and it didn't go that way.
No, it didn't at all. You're starting to see some reckoning there. The Washington Post had a piece, I think a week ago, that pretty much went down the list and explained the timeline and the major conceptual failures of COVAX. Interestingly, Gates was barely mentioned, even though it was pretty much staffed by his people and run by his people and was very much his brainchild.
My understanding is that the entire project was really just a way in which to sort of intercede in the idea that there's going to be shared knowledge for all of these vaccinations.
Yeah, at the time that he introduced COVAX and the accelerator of which it was a part, because it also dealt with therapeutics, the larger framework, there was a mechanism being developed within the WHO called the COVID Technology Access Pool, which was going to be a globally shared resource in which all governments and corporations would temporarily, for the duration of the pandemic, place their IP. So there could be, research without walls. The idea that would accelerate development and also accelerate scale up, because once you have vaccines and therapeutics, you have to make a lot of them if you have a pandemic affecting billions of people. And he showed up. He landed and he said, no, none of that's necessary. And he used his influence, his many armed influence, to basically steer governments away from it. And basically say that the companies are right. We can tap into the better instincts and charity and, benevolence of big pharma. And their patron states can solve this problem without any outside the box thinking.
I mean, that's a kind of a macro copy of what we see here in the United States, where philanthropy is a way to avoid taxation and larger cuts into the coffers of rich people and corporations. And then on the international level, waiving IP would stop the gravy train, even though these pharmaceutical companies made a ton of money. As is, but it would stop eventually if you were to waive IP. And so then there's like conversations about, let's make it about donations, because then it's all on your terms.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a much more friendly terrain for corporations whose main and only concern is maintaining IP. And it's worth remembering that at the beginning of the pandemic, when the first billions were offered in Operation Warp Speed, a group of Democratic congressmen tried to revive this older liberal tradition of publicly funded science in the public interest under some minimal public constraints. And what was pharma's response? Stephen Ubel, the guy who runs the main lobbying group, said, if you try to attach even the slightest social obligations to this tranche of $8 billion, we will take our ball and we will go home. We will not participate.
I understand that threat, and I also just need to just like editorialize for a second. The reason why you don't want to allow for the existence of billionaires is because I think Bill Gates is not doing this to make money as much as like the guy's a loon about this stuff, and it's his ideology, and it just so happens that because he's a billionaire, he gets to impose his ideology on the entire world when it comes to vaccinations. That's just like, you should not be allowed to have that much power in a country or the world, period. End of story. But yeah. This part about we'll take the ball and go home. Two-part question. One is, was it within the ability of the U.S. government to say, fine, because there's other people who have other balls. And if we develop this with our money, They're going to sign up for it. A and B, do we have a sense of like just how much money was expended on the development of these vaccines? You know, let's, we can take the mRNA. We can also take, the Johnson & Johnson. And how much money was expended on the development of these vaccines in pure dollar amounts versus the amount that the U.S. government either gave them as, you know, money directly in terms of the development for those vaccines or in the promise of whatever you come up with, we're going to give you $1 billion worth of orders, which is like, you know, if I, you know, I'm going to start my podcast and someone comes up to me and goes like, look, we're not going to put any money into you, you know, hiring people and putting the computers, but we're going to promise to buy $1 million worth of advertising from you, regardless of what you come up with. I'd be like, all right, I'll put that money into these computers because I know I get $1 million coming. And that's sort of the deal that we had to fight, right?
Something like that. Regarding the ease with which we could have walked away, it would have been a lot easier if there hadn't been disinvestment or a complete rejection of the creation of some sort of public sector with pharmaceuticals. And part of the story of the last 40 years in around the world was a privatization, disinvestment in public sector pharmaceuticals in Europe, which is now why you're seeing more and more conversations about we need to get that capacity back so we're not dependent on corporations, foreign or domestic. We have to be able to do this on our own. Without that, because we have been so enthralled to the privatization, private contractor model, we did need probably significant corporate partnerships. Now, within that, there is a lot of historical precedent for the government maintaining a role as a senior partner, going all the way back to the penicillin project during World War II. There are legal rights the government has to perform that role, even outside of an emergency conduct context, as during the pandemic. I'm sure you've talked about a lot of these on the show, not just in Bayh-Dole, but you know, the Defense Authorization Act. There are a lot of levers in the government toolbox that could have been used that just were not. I mean, basically, the industry got what it always gets and what it has come to expect as its birthright, which is everything on its terms with zero demands in the public interest or the government making any sort of even feigning self-respect in terms of enforcing the rights that any industry would themselves claim under a similar arrangement. You know, these companies would never in a million years forfeit the rights that the government does on a routine basis with these contracts.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. Alexander Zajcik, author of Owning the Sun, A People's History of Monopoly Medicine from Aspirin to COVID-19 Vaccines.
I love the title.
It's a really important book, I think, for people to understand this dynamic. And because it tells the story of both this dynamic of socializing the cost and privatizing the profits. It tells the story of the implications of that, particularly in terms of medicine, where we have, you know, God knows how many people have died and will die because of the privatization of these vaccines. And it also tells the story of like how sort of incrementally, it's almost like the frog in the boiling water. First, you limit the capacity of governments to produce these things. Then you give them these companies the leverage, and then it's, you know, it's off to the races. I really appreciate your coming on, and we will put a link to Owning the Sun at majority.fm and in our podcast descriptions and whatnot. Really appreciate
it. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.
All right, folks. It is time for us to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls. We will take your plaudits for the live show.
Plaudits? I don't even know what that word is.
It's possible I made it up.
It's like applause, right?
Yes. Isn't it? It's like congratulations.
Like if you applaud something, you're given it plaudits.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. No. Is that not every day? No, I'm...
Like it's very easy to question my use of the words, but I think it's plaudits. Right?
I think that works, yeah.
No, it's names you have issues with, not really words.
No, it's with names.
Yeah.
But I also... there are times where I realize that I'm old, and words that I think, you know, just have gone out of favor.
Yeah, I don't hear a lot of people saying plaudits anymore.
Like for me, like I go, oh, everybody says plaudits.
I love the plaudits.
Thanks. Like spelled like plaud, plaudits.
P-L-A-U-D-I-T-S.
Yeah, yeah, expression of praise or approval. I mean, that's on me for not knowing that.
You know, you should have known that one, because that is one of those big words that comes up a lot in a sporting context. Like,
it does?
The plaudits, like an athlete, at like the ESPYs or something, you'd hear about plaudits, I feel like.
There are times where I just sort of feel like the words I know are just like old-timey words.
I mean...
Start listening to like the battle cry of freedom. Fiddle music.
I'm trying to think of like, Janine used to use a lot of like old timey words too, but like for comedic effect. And now I was just trying to say, look, come hither.
Right.
Anyways.
Hither and thither were nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Bring that back.
Oh, back in the mid 70s, everybody used that. Folks, it's your support that makes the show possible. You realize that by now, don't you? You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half too. And you get other great things. Oh, we're going to release the live show for members.
Oh, nice.
In fact, we should do that.
I forgot to ask. The live stream went off without a hitch.
My understanding is it totally did.
Nice.
And we have the link to it, right, Bradley? So we're going to upload that for members. We will go public with it, and maybe we'll put some clips up too, you know, in the coming days, if not weeks. But members are going to get that bad boy.
Oh, no.
What?
No, I mean, it'll be fine.
The Samantha said.
Yeah. Right. It's just like that now it's going to be public what we did at the live show.
Well, it was sort of public before.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Well, now all the right wing is going to clip it and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Illuminati things. Kid says Emma wasn't around for the years of Sam using turpitude incorrectly. That's true. That is true.
Yeah. What is turpitude mean?
Is it like turpentine?
Turpitude. I can't remember what I thought it was now, but I did like sort of like completely forget. I completely banned it from my.
J.K. Rowling's got a turpitude.
Oh, gosh.
It is
depravity or wickedness.
Yes. And I think I was using it as like, the opposite.
Gumption or something.
No, I was using it as like moral turpitude. I thought was like, you know, like almost like integrity or something. I may have used it backwards.
But it was the opposite.
It turns out to be. Yeah.
Okay.
So I was around, you know, people do that also with a cursory. I find.
Oh, because cursory is meant to be more of an in-depth look, but people say it's just a glance.
Ah, no. It's opposite. It is not in-depth.
Oh.
Bingo.
Wait, so I was doing it right then.
No, yeah. No. It is, people think it is supposed to be in-depth.
Who thinks that?
Oh, no. A cursory glance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like there were people who do.
Well.
That makes me feel better, because I have like my share of malapropisms where I miss.
Maybe it was a different word that people used differently, but
let's say nuclear, and I'm never going to change that.
No,
I grew up under Bush. That's
I still can't spell restaurant. Yeah.
Folks, join the majority report. Com. Also,
you.
I don't know that we're going to do a live stream of the Boston show. They do not have the same technology that Bell House did.
Wow.
Can you believe it? The Wilbur didn't, I guess the Wilbur did not do live streaming events like the Bell House did. Like we went to the Bell House in 2019. They didn't have any of that stuff. And now they have this whole setup where there's like, you know, multiple cameras that are there. It was for free.
I mean, good for them. Like that's a great way to attract podcasts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We may shoot it. I'm not sure. I'm looking into all of this in Boston, but I'll tell you now, you're going to want to see this show. Go to Majority Live and click on the link for the Boston show and buy a ticket. There's still a couple, still, I think probably like 15% of the tickets are left, I think is the number. But this is, what do you call it? Assigned seating. So get in now while the getting is good. The Wilbur Theater is a beautiful theater, though. I don't know if there's a bad seat in the house, to be honest with you. But special guest. Now,
John Benjamin and Larry Murphy are not going to be in physical attendance because of the Bob's Burgers movie. Apparently, the impress.
But Benjamin was kind enough to come to the Bell House one.
Yes, yeah. And they may have a presentation. But I will tell you this: when they told me that they weren't coming, first it was Larry. He said, "Like, I don't know if I can come, man, because we were going to do press for Bob's Burgers." And I'm like, if we had not secured the special guest, I would have been like, oh, Jesus, how are we going to replace them? And I was like, you're lost. Because I know you dudes would have liked to have hung out with this guy or gal or they or them. I'm not going to give it away.
Okay.
This person in the green room. Now you can't. So
sad.
Sad. So sad. That could be a clue. So sad. It could be a clue. Maybe it's not.
It's Donald Trump, everybody.
Matt.
I would love to hang out.
Why would you do that?
I spoiled it.
All right. Well, how about you spoil for us what's on the in the Matt Leckie and media universe?
Yeah, the Enterprise universe or like Star Trek. We have Andrew Perez of the newly rechristened The Leveler, which levelernews.com, which used to be the Daily Poster. We're going to be talking about a pharma front group that has cinemas back and the Coke machine pressing the Supreme Court to crush the EPA, and also another story he's got coming out tomorrow. So that will be Wednesday, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get our post game.
All right, folks, don't forget.
Oh, sorry. I just want to plug this, too. For patrons, we'd talk with Matt McManus. He reviewed James Lindsay's Race Marxism book that just came out that said that CRT is actually Marxism. And we get into why that's extremely confusing. Look, James Lindsay is an autodidact. He's, I think he was taught in mathematics, so his understanding of concepts like Marxism or even liberalism or even history leaves a lot to be desired. So we get into that with Matt McManus.
Also, I should say that we're going to post at one point. I know I'm in deep negotiations with Ronald Reagan, but the original video that Ronald Reagan did.
Oh my God.
The uncensored one.
The uncensored one we'll put up. Like we censored him a little bit, which is just like, He loved the fact that we were censoring him because he, of course, has a new Substack called The Posit.
Substack. I subscribed.
Substack, which is all about the supposed censoring of him, it appears. And
it's nice, this conflation of editorial and censorship.
Yep. He's like, you're censoring me. And I'm like, well, too bad.
And well, that's why I need to create
to
a Substack.
Fit into his whole thing. So
we'll keep tabs pause on
that.
Him
he
there.
Did a yeah. supposed expose on me. It was disgusting, full of lies. We will post it at one point.
He put the human container in a human container.
Yeah. Disgusting. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Check out Just Coffee. Get some MR blend. See you in the fun half. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second.
Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this, 7A?
Yes.
Me? Your thing?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
is you? Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop. You call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about yeah. you is just like every day, all day, like yeah. everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
folks.
Love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. You gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.